Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Most of today's show is an encore edition of Local Talk featuring the topic of one-room schoolhouses. Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson interview folks involved in restoring and preserving country schools and a couple of Ames residents who attended one-room schools as children. But first, I'm bringing you a slice of today's reality in Iowa with a new mini-feature called Deconstructing Bill Dix. Bill Dix is the Senate Majority Leader who lives in Butler County but serves much of Story County, including Nevada, Huxley, Kelly, and Story City. We captured his words recently at a legislative forum in Huxley. Now we are trying to understand those words one by one. I brought in Dave Swenson, Iowa State economist, to help me with the first edition of Deconstructing Bill Dix, in which we look at House Study Bill 92. So, House Study Bill 92, Dave Swenson, the main focus has been on the minimum wage preemption. Four counties, Wapello, Polk, Lynn, and Johnson, have taken steps to increase minimum wages in their county, and this bill would eliminate that.
That's exactly right, and it's an exertion of state power over local government, something we've seen often. And in this case, and by the way, we're talking about Bill Dix, but it's also a move championed by the governor to eliminate local government's ability to set minimum wages and to reassert that right or that obligation at the state level.
So currently the state level is set with the federal level at $7.25 per hour. Some of the counties who have changed that include Polk County, where it's set to go step by step up to $10.75 an hour by 2019. Wapello County, which is the home of Ottumwa, a real working class town, has a similar step by step raise of the minimum wage reaching $10.10 by 2019. So $3 difference.
There is a $3 difference. And if you look out there at what most businesses are already paying, they're paying in excess of the state or the federal minimum wage. You go to fast food operations and you'll very often see the sign advertising starting pay at 9. We have a new Walmart going up on the north side of Ames, and I'm not sure, but I think the pay is $11.50 an hour. But there are a lot of places, though, that still pay the minimum wage quite belligerently, and they're not going to pay any more. And so there is a fraction of the workforce that is stuck at minimum wage. They're disproportionately located in service industries, hotels, motels, food service industries. They're located in grocery stores and those types of operations. So the minimum wage is still widely paid. Employers can get away with it. You know, the minimum wage is a piece of legislation that tells employers you can't pay them less. And that's really what it does. And there are plenty of employers out there, given different circumstances, that would pay less if they could get away with it.
And so the Republicans in power are seeking to eliminate the ability of locales, and it's even been discussed in Ames, I know, informally, to raise the minimum wage and provide people a starting ground that's a little bit more reasonable, maybe. There are other aspects of the bill that involve home rule about other regulations.
For the most part, the things that were talked about in this bill and the ancillary conversations have to do with minimum wage, sick pay, and other kind of labor-related issues, not wanting local governments to begin to establish what we would just simply say are more progressive, worker-friendly policies, not just in terms of pay, but also overall conditions of work and conditions of labor and conditions of employment. Let me make a point, though, about home rule here in Iowa. Iowa likes to say that it is a home rule state, but it has very minor home rule powers. Iowa is what we call in urban planning. It's a Dillon rule state, and Dillon's rule, it's a piece of dicta that was part of a ruling back in the 19th century by a Des Moines judge who basically said local governments are creatures of the state. And in Iowa, the state has often treated them as creatures who are to be controlled. And so when they get a little bit ahead of themselves, when they get a little bit innovative, oftentimes state government will smack them down. They've done it in education. They've done it at county level. Hog confinements is a great one where people wanted to exert local authority. And of course, the state preempted that by saying, no, 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 this is now, we're going to reserve this, these rulemaking powers to the state.
And so it's about power. Is it about anything else? Does it have an economic impact in a way that the state likes to measure economic impact?
Making a place desirable for labor to come. Iowa does not have a surplus of labor. If anything, Iowa has a problem with its skilled labor leaving the state of Iowa. Attracting labor and making Iowa a worker-friendly place is an issue for Iowa, especially for its non-metropolitan areas that are continuing to contract and are struggling to find a wide range of workers. People who are at the lower income levels who make the minimum wage turn right around and spend that money in the regional economy, and you get that nice multiplier effect. It doesn't kill jobs. It doesn't cut jobs. It doesn't run businesses out of business. If I'm a restaurant on Main Street on the north side, and I'm a restaurant on Main Street on the south side, and your costs all go up exactly the same amount, your competitive position hasn't changed at all. So the argument that it drives people out of business is quite facile. Most evidence suggests that's just not the case.
Okay, well, let's listen to what Bill Dix, okay, Senate Majority Leader, says about this minimum wage preemption bill, and then we'll discuss it.
Talking about minimum wage, we want to focus on policies that are going to compensate Iowans in a skilled fashion. We're going to continue to work on proposals to help make services available to retrain and train Iowa workers for the jobs that are available, but also making sure that the employers who are looking at Iowa as a state to locate or to grow in, that it's one that they can do so efficiently and effectively. And if you're asking them to have... No, these are high-paying jobs, sir. And if you're asking them to have a patchwork of regulatory burdens on a city-by-city or county-by-county, it just makes it very difficult. West Des Moines sits in four counties. How is an employer, a job creator, supposed to manage that in an effective manner that allows you as employees to compete in today's world? If it makes sense to have a minimum wage city-by-city, doesn't it make sense to have standard time city by city? It's the same kind of thing.
So that was Bill Dix speaking about House Study Bill 92 that would preempt minimum wage hikes in four counties in Iowa and the opportunity for other counties to increase their minimum wage. David Swenson, I got a little confused there when I was listening to Bill Dix there.
Well, you should have been confused. He was doing two things there from what I can tell. He was talking about Iowa's competitiveness and its ability to attract high-paying, good jobs, and then somehow linking it to the minimum wage debate. Well, it doesn't make sense to link it to the minimum wage debate. And that's what he's doing initially here. And so he's saying companies don't want to come here if they have to pay more than the minimum wage, but that these are high-skilled, high-paying jobs. It doesn't make sense. There's a certain amount of illogic associated with that statement. I'm not too sure he said what he meant to say, is the best I can say.
He goes on and he talks about how is an employer supposed to manage that, all of these different regulatory burdens, in a way that allows you as employees to compete in today's world. Do you have any idea what he was talking about when he talked about employees competing in today's world?
No, I don't have any idea. There is an idea among many that workers should be allowed to bargain for their wages as low as they want to bargain for their wages, not as high, but as low. And so that's one way to think about it, that this is keeping workers from working for less money because they're willing to do that. That's one way to think about it. I have no other idea what he might be alluding to, though, there.
Okay. And then the final analogy he made was that between setting a minimum wage city by city, county by county, and setting standard time, like Indianapolis, you know, has its own crazy
sure.
time warp and setting that city by city.
Yeah, well, okay, so first of all, he was really stretching for an analogy, and he stretched too far. I want to back up, though, a little bit, because he talked about somebody wanting to come to West Des Moines, and West Des Moines sitting in four counties, and that somehow a Polk County minimum wage that's different than Dallas or Madison or any of the other areas around there somehow impinges on that business's ability to do business, it doesn't make sense at all. First of all, a company doesn't come and locate in four counties. A company comes and locates in one county. Second of all, if it's a good-paying, high-skilled job, they're not paying the minimum wage, and this argument doesn't have anything to do with them. If they are the kind of company that's coming in and it is paying the minimum wage, again, it's likely going to be located in one spot. And it very well may pick, for one reason or another, a place that does or does not have the higher level of minimum wage. But there's no evidence that the growth in Dallas County or the growth in the Polk County side of West Des Moines necessarily will be impinged upon by a differential minimum wage. We have studies like this that are in different places. One side of Washington versus Idaho, for example, Pullman, Washington versus Moscow, Idaho, and minimum wage. We have lots of these little natural experiments, and people say, well, it's gonna constrain growth in one side and boost growth in another side. Well, no, it doesn't. It simply doesn't. There's no evidence that it does. And in generally the case, it's generally the case in these kinds of studies that we've seen over time, is that the places with the higher minimum wage that were set either statewide or locally have faster growth than the places with the lower minimum wage. So a lot of the argument against the minimum wage is just basically saying, don't tell me what to pay workers. I don't want you to do that. But the other part of this, it has to do with irresponsibility on the part of the state government in Iowa. Local governments wouldn't be asserting themselves had there been a progressive approach to the minimum wage over time. I have been on record saying, well, I find this fragmented process somewhat of a, it's a lot of work for something that ought not have to be done at the local level. Why isn't state government taking the lead on this and making it be known that Iowa is a state that prides its workers? And one of the ways that it prides itself in its workers is by enacting laws that boost the minimum wage.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that. Dave Swenson, thank you so much for commenting on House Study Bill 92 and helping us deconstruct Bill Dix.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Now sit back and enjoy this encore presentation on one-room schoolhouses by Local Talk hosts Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson. They start with Bill Sherman, who works with an organization called Preservation Iowa.
And we're ready right now with Bill Sherman to give us some background on the days when there was a schoolhouse within 2 miles of every child in school age. This is a big story, and Bill is the perfect person to tell us about it. So could you tell us a little about yourself and about the work of Preservation Iowa trying to preserve those country schools?
I got interested in the whole issue of country schooling in the mid-1990s when I started working on a book project for the Iowa State Education Association. The book was Tributes to Iowa Teachers, and three persons who attended one-room schools wrote tributes to their one-room school teacher. That tricked my curiosity, and I wondered how many country schools were there in Iowa at one time, and I knew there weren't any operating, or I didn't think there were any operating in Iowa. I went to the library and found no information. There were articles that people had written reminiscing about their one-room school experiences, but no really hard data. So I decided to try and do another book to find out how many buildings were standing, and no research, and I concluded I couldn't do that by myself, so we developed a survey and worked to find volunteers in each of Iowa's 99 counties who would do the ground-level research. We asked two basic questions. How many buildings that had been used as one- and two-room schools were still standing in your county, and how are they being used today? And we eventually, after a couple of years, did get results back from each of the counties.
So this is like a census of the one-room schools, is that right?
Yes.
Now, how many were there at the high point, and what was the high point?
Well, in 1901, we had 12,623 operating 1 and 2 room schools in Iowa. And that's according to data in the biannual report issued by the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. So I consider that the high point. We had started consolidating one-room schools, but Iowa was still growing. The rural areas were still expanding with new farmers coming in. So even though we were consolidating, by that time we still had more new schools coming online that raised the total.
Well, I first became aware of this issue when I was with Paul Wearson, and we were doing an interview with an old farmer who had attended a one-room school. And Paul told me that there was a one-room school within 2 miles of every child in Iowa. Is that right?
Well, it's close to being right. The legislature actually passed a law saying that these country schools should be located so that no child would have to walk more than 2 miles to get to a school. Of course, we didn't have any form of mass transportation, and roads in many parts of Iowa were impassable, so the only way children could get to school would be to walk. In some counties, we had rivers and rugged terrain, towns and cities, and so we didn't have a school every 2 miles, but we had them located so that no one should have to walk more than 2 miles.
Well, now, when they did start having more, I guess you wouldn't exactly call it consolidation, but there was an issue you mentioned with the state school board, where there was an election for a school board official. Could you tell me that story again so that our listeners could hear it?
Okay, well, it was really a historic election that was held in 1921, and there were 3 candidates for state superintendent of public instruction that were running for the Republican nomination. And in those days, the Republican Party was the dominant party in Iowa, and so whoever won the Republican nomination would likely be elected to the state office. 3 candidates, Mae Francis, P.E. McClanahan, and Mr. Booth. McClanahan and Booth were officials in the State Department of Public Instruction. They both favored further consolidation of country schools. Mae Francis, the woman who at that time was serving as supervisor of rural schools in Iowa, and she would travel about the state of Iowa working with local educators and farmers to try and improve the one-room schools. She understood the economic climate and the decline in income that farmers were facing because of falling commodity prices. The 2 men, as I said, well, we need to continue to consolidate the one-room schools to ensure that children get an adequate education. Mae Francis said, no, we can't do that because farmers can't afford to pay higher property taxes. And Mae was right. She won the Republican primary and then went on to win the general election as a champion of continuing to improve the one-room school. The other significant factor about that election, Mae became the first woman in Iowa elected to statewide office. She kind of broke the glass ceiling in terms of elected women to statewide office.
Could you give me some idea of how dense this population was, for example, by county, by township?
Well, if we had a perfect grid system in a township, we could have 9 country schools located in a township, spread 2 miles apart, or actually 4 miles apart. So we could have 9 schools in a township. Most Iowa counties had 16 townships, so we could have upwards of 144 country schools located in Iowa. There were a few counties, because of their shape, actually had more than that, and then others had less. In 1901, most counties had more than 100 operating one- and two-room schools.
I understand that a lot of the work now of the Preservation Iowa is in helping people preserve those remaining schools. Do you have any idea of how many of those schools are still in existence?
Yes. Once we got all the county reports tabulated, we identified almost 3,000 schools that were standing in some form in Iowa in 1998. The most common way that these school buildings were being used was as some type of residence. And today, we still have some new school buildings that are being remodeled and turned into some type of home. We also identified more than 1,100 schools were used as some type of farm building or a storage shed, a hay barn, a place to park vehicles, various types of farm buildings. The good thing that was happening is that we had nearly 188 of these school buildings were being restored as some type of museum facility, a building that was put back into the form that it was in when children were attending, equipped with school desks, furniture, readers, and so forth. And because of the work of Preservation Iowa and several other people, we've had an increase in the number of buildings being restored as a museum facility. And now in Iowa in 2015, we have over 200 schools that are restored as a museum facility, and we have at least one in every county in Iowa. And one of the cases or statements I made after we got all this data compiled was that Iowa should be considered as America's country school capital, in that we have more buildings standing, more schools preserved, and more schools listed on the National Register of Historic Places than any other state in the United States.
That's quite an achievement, and we're going to be spending the rest of the hour talking with people who are either involved in some kind of preservation or have some memories. So I thank you so much for being with us and telling us all these great things, and thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for taking time to discover and report about this issue, and maybe that will encourage some of our other listeners to look at preserving a school building that may be in their area.
Thank you. And I'd like to just mention the ones that I discovered online in our listening area, and I'm sure that there are more, but they are all pretty impressive. The Story City Historical Society has the Sheldahl School, and that's very well developed with the pictures as well as the names of all the teachers. And the Boone County Historical Society has Hickory Grove School. Haley School is southeast of Nevada, and the Harmony Center School in Wilson Brewer Park in Webster City, and the Hoggett School, run by the Ames History Center, is located on the school grounds of Meeker School. So there are lots of chances for people to visit some of these museums.
For listeners who tuned in late, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've been speaking with Bill Sherman, who heads the County Schools Project for Preservation Iowa, that helps people interested in restoring the surviving one- or two-room schoolhouses. Next, we'll hear from Barb McDougall about the specifics of Cole School near Boone and how that restoration developed as a school and community project. But first, a little music. Well, we're about to interview Barb McDougall, who's here today. You're involved in restoring the Cole Schoolhouse. Tell me what inspired that project for you.
Well, it was back in 2006, and I was going to be installed as regent of our local DAR chapter, Deshaun chapter, here in Boone. And whenever we have a new regent, the regent chooses a chapter project to work on. And the objectives of our society are education, patriotism, and historic preservation. So I had driven by this schoolhouse on my way to work every day, and it was just in a deplorable state, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if we worked on preserving that? The mortar was falling out. There were holes in the brick. The cedar shingles had been covered by tin, and that was coming off. All the windows were broken out. So I really thought, if we don't do something, this isn't going to last another year. So I talked to the landowners, Phil and Annette Meyer, and they very much wanted it saved. And so they gave the building and an acre of land to us to restore it.
Well, that's great. Now, money is involved when you're doing a preservation project. How did you pursue money?
Well, first I should tell you, I guess, that our first grant came from the Department of Ed. And the way that happened is about the time I was thinking about doing this project, I talked to the principal at one of our elementary buildings, Dan Gould. And he had just been to a conference and heard someone talk about getting kids involved in historic preservation. And so we kind of put our heads together and thought, well, maybe if the DAR hooks up with the Boone Schools, we could get this accomplished. And so that summer I went to a national conference of the National Country School Association of America in DeKalb, Illinois. And there I met Bill Sherman from Des Moines, who I think you were just interviewing. And he became my mentor, as he has done for so many people who have wanted to restore country schoolhouses. And I found that he hosts every year in October an Iowa Country School Conference. And so I started going to that as well. And actually, this year's conference is going to be hosted in Boone. And the director of our historical museum, Pam Schwartz, has given us a lot of support for the project, too. And so by hooking up with the Boone Schools, I was able to get a $10,000 service learning grant from the Department of Education to get the kids involved. And so that kind of jump-started the project. And the kids became little entrepreneurs. They made all kinds of crafts to sell. They held bake sales. They sold candy at basketball games. They just did a lot of things to raise money for the project. And the PTO was very supportive. They held a carnival for all the kids with the proceeds going to the restoration project. And then I began writing other grants. And so we've received grants from the State Historical Society. They have a grant specifically for country school preservation. So that has been very helpful. We got grants from Barilla America, from Walmart, Thrivent Lutheran Services, Modern Woodmen of America, the Pratt Fenton Trust, and Country School Association of America.
That's great. Look at all the things you did to be creative to make that happen.
Well, it takes a village, as they say.
Well, I'm so glad you involved children because they have a learning experience and understanding why they're doing this. And, of course, kids, when they sign on to a project, it gets done. Now, Barb, you're a member of DAR, is that right?
That's right.
Is that the Daughters of the American Revolution?
That's correct.
Wow. And they're here in Iowa, too. They're everywhere.
Yeah. We have, 52 chapters, 50 chapters, I'm not sure.
Well, now, what's unusual about this building that you have there, the Cole School building? What's special about it?
Well, we think the best thing about it is that it is one of the few brick schoolhouses left in Iowa. And what's really special is that it's constructed of three layers of brick. There's actually two outside layers and then an airspace of 2 or 3 inches and then an inside layer of brick. And so we suspect that that probably was for insulation purposes. And we think that the brick came from Yegi Brickyard here in Boone, which later became the Boone Brick and Tile Company. which was a very important brick company in the Midwest. And
what years was the school in use?
1888 to 1933.
And what have you learned? What have you learned about the builders, or the people who put it together, or the teachers? Have you done some research on the families and children and all the folks?
As far as the builders, we haven't been able to find out exactly who did that. But I did do a lot of research at the library to find out about the teachers and the children, and also at the historical museum. And we have, when we started the project 9 years ago, we had two gentlemen in town who attended Cole School. One of them was Bill Ross, and he has since passed away. And the other one is Orville Nelson, who still lives in Boone and has been our biggest supporter of the project. And he is just waiting for us to get it finished. So he's very excited about it.
Well, what have you been accomplishing so far? Where are you in the project? You've got some folks working on this. You have a contractor?
Yes. We hired Renaissance Restoration from Galena, Illinois. And we were just amazed that they would take our little brick schoolhouse, because they've done some amazing projects around the Midwest. Their specialty is brick restoration. And so far they have repointed all the brick. They've restored the limestone foundation, taken the cement that had been put over it, taken that off. They've placed new windowsills and a door stoop, and put windows in. And they actually got period glass from another old building to use. So
that's just terrific.
Authentic.
Now, you had a roofing company too, right?
Yes, we hired Pritchard Construction from Ogden, and they put a cedar roof on, cedar shingles. And then our Boone High School construction class, under the direction of Mike Hankey, has done a lot of work out there. They pulled up the old floorboards and repaired the joists. They laid a floor using reclaimed lumber from a barn down the road. And now they've been working on fixing the rafters and installing a new ceiling.
And then
my husband did a lot of the wall repair, fixing the big cracks with mortar and then replastering. And I should mention, too, kind of a fun point, one of our members' husbands, Lloyd Tagason, even built an outhouse for us.
An outhouse. It's indispensable.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, now you're attempting to get the building listed on the National Historic Register. What is involved with that? That's quite a project, too, I think.
Well, we knew from the beginning that we wanted to try for that. And I kind of put it on hold because we were in the middle of the restoration, and that kind of took, you know, most of our time. But this past year, I started working on the application, and I'm hoping that it's going to be accepted soon.
That's pretty involved, I think, to get those any building registered on the National Historic Register.
It is. It takes a lot of research and documentation.
And you're still applying for grants and money, I take it. Is that right, Barb?
Well, I haven't recently, but we have received some other grants besides, I told you about the grants, I guess. And then we also got some donations from some of our local organizations, which was very nice. We got from the American Legion and Kiwanis and Questers, and then a number of individuals have given us donations, so that's very helpful. And we even got some donations of some artifacts already, like a Victrola and a merry-go-round and school desks and
teaching. Hey, that's wonderful, Barb. I'm so thrilled about what you're doing here. It's been satisfying for you, I'm sure. Look at all the people that's in the community who've plugged in, particularly children. And this is going to be a great thing when it all gets finished and furnished. Susan, what do you think about this?
Well, I think it's great, but I'd like to know, I've already been asked by our guests, where is this school? How can people find it?
Okay, it's just northeast of Boone on R Avenue. So you can remember R for Red Brick Schoolhouse. So it's 2.5 miles northeast of Boone. It's on E26 on the north side of Boone. Then you go a quarter of a mile north on Gravel, which is R Avenue.
Well, thank you so much. I can hardly wait till it's finished and we can...
And it won't be long. We're hoping to get it finished up this spring and have a big event out there.
We've been listening to Barb McDougall telling us about the Cole School, and we need a little ragtime, which Bill Sherman told me is the appropriate music for this era. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Now we have some guests with us in the studio to tell about the experiences of attending school in a one-room schoolhouse. I'm Susan Franzen, one of your hosts. But my co-host, Paul Wearson, is the one who really knows about this subject. So I'll turn this over to you, Paul.
Well, this will really be a test of my knowledge, but I want to introduce a friend of mine, actually, Bob Jensen of Gilbert, who... He won't tell you, but he's a great actor. I've seen him on stage. But he's not here today as an actor. He's going to be talking about the county schools, the country schools of Franklin Township, and his father, whose parents were Danish immigrants. Welcome to our program, Bob.
Thank you very much for having me. I consider it to be an honor.
Well, it's good to have you here. And just tell us about that school that your father attended.
Well, the school's name was Union, and it was located in Section 15 in Franklin Township. If any of you are familiar with this area, it was directly across the road from what is now the Moose Lodge, what used to be the Oaks Golf Course. My father started a school there in the year 1909. His parents were both Danish immigrants coming over here, my grandfather in 1893, my grandmother in 1899. Neither of my grandparents at that time spoke very much English. And in the home, the only thing that was spoken was Danish. So my father and his brother were sent down the road a half mile where they started attending school without the ability to speak the English language. Consequently, they struggled. I have had in my possession for quite a while the roster of the school kids at that, attending that school, and they had very few children, but for some reason they designated them by number. Their names were listed, so it's easy to determine which number your person was. And my father and his brother, Einar, were... let me say, evaluated as being rather deficient in the English language. And this was a problem for my father for the rest of his life. He never pronounced his THs quite correctly. If I was to go to the field to cut thistles, it was given to me as an instruction, go cut the thistles today. And we, as eight children, constantly laughed at my father's situation.
Did he talk about how many students were at that school?
There is a picture of my father along with the students that were there, and as it looks to me like there were one dozen, and there were a number of Danish immigrant children. Along Highway 69 at that time, from about 190th Street up to the Gilbert Corner and slightly a little further north, the land was pretty much all owned by Danish immigrants. Now, Gilbert's kind of an unusual community in itself because there are different enclaves strung out through the system. At the north end of Gilbert, there's lots of Norwegians. At the northwest, there's lots of Germans. And it just so happened that the Danes kind of accumulated right along Highway 69. So I'm sure that there were a lot of kids that had the same experiences throughout that particular township. There were nine in Franklin Township because it was a nice square township, and most of those closed up in 1917 and came to Gilbert. Now, there were a few holdouts that decided they wanted to stay in existence for a while. I know the Bloomington School at the old Bloomington Village continued to operate at least into the fairly late 40s. That's pretty much the case. You know, the one-room school experience, to me, I'm a retired teacher, by the way. I taught for 22 years. Now there's a popular term, mentoring, to be used in the school districts now. This is not brand new. This has been going on forever. In the country school experience with kids ranging from first grade through eighth grade, a mentoring was an absolute necessity. That if you wanted enough kids to play ball out at recess time, the big kids had to be good to the little kids or they wouldn't have enough to field a team. So I think there was lots and lots of positive things coming out of the one-room school experience. You also had built into the system a remedial program. If you were a little bit slower and you listened to the lessons of the younger kids, you picked up stuff you missed the first time around. If you were academically capable and you were a first grader or a second grader, you might already learn your multiplication tables because you're listening to the third, fourth, fifth graders doing their lessons. So there was a lot of positives about this situation. The breadth of the curriculum and things like that was probably a detriment. But there are certainly a lot of things that were really, really positive.
You know, that was, Bob, that's very informative. When you place it in that context, all the kids helping one another, and review happens for the older kids when they teach the younger kids, is there's a flavor of we're all in this together. And when you talk about your father and the Danish immigrants who were learning English as a second language, that echoes into today. If you went to Marshalltown or populations in Iowa where there is quite a representation of immigrants, these are kids who are doing the same thing your grandfather did. So there's nothing new under the sun, and we are all and were and are immigrants.
That's for sure. It's you know, I had one other experience, and I didn't go to a one-room schoolhouse because Gilbert was, quote, progressive, where they had consolidated in 1917 for the most part. But I started a school in the fall of 1948. Now, we're talking about 3 years after the end of the war.
That was the year I went. It was a good year.
It was 3 years after the end of World War II, and there were millions of displaced people in Europe. And I'll never forget, halfway through our first grade year, a little girl came into our classroom who had woolen socks clear up past her knees and a very colorful skirt and sweater and things of this nature that was pretty foreign to most of the kids in our class. And I remember her coming in and the look of consternation on her face because she could not speak one word of English. And she started to cry, and she was only there for 2 days. And they must have decided that they were going to move her to another less traumatic place to go to school. At that point, even at that age, you know, I could identify with her and listening to my father's experiences and think how she must have felt to have had come into that type of environment.
That's a great story. And just imagine how she felt. And Susan, we have two other guests in the studio here that you can introduce for us.
Yes, thank you for sharing all that you know about these schools. And actually, we now have two people who experienced those mentoring situations. And now the other two that we have are two friends of mine, Sam Wormley and Larry Kirschen.
Good to be with you this morning.
When did you go to the country schools?
Well, I started in 1942. That would have been when I was in kindergarten. I went to a country school near Walnut, Iowa, southwestern Iowa, Pottawatomie County. I went there for my entire grade school career up until the eighth grade. In eighth grade, I went to town school, but kindergarten through seventh grade, I went to the country school. I might add that I had the same teacher for the first seven of those 8 years until I was in the seventh grade. I got a different teacher, but I had the same teacher for the first years of that experience.
Let's also bring in Sam for your comparison.
In 1948, when I was just 4 years old, there was a big fire in our farm community, and it was the schoolhouse, and it burnt down. During that coming school year, the students were in a chicken house with a wood stove, fire heater, and the building was rebuilt during that year. And so when I started kindergarten in 1949, I got to be in this brand new building. It was a one-room schoolhouse, and there were outhouses outside. But in the second year, there were outhouses inside. They were still that kind of toilet, but you went in the doorway and you went to the left and that was the girls, and you went to the right and that was the boys. I look back at it very fondly. One wall was all bookshelves and it was a library. We had windows on two sides. There was a coal furnace in the basement, and the older kids would be the ones responsible for shoveling in coal and cobs and so on to heat in the wintertime. And so I was there from kindergarten through the eighth grade. And when I finished eighth grade, that school closed down. It was called Newton Number 6. It was also called Hammer School because the farm land that was donated for the school was from the family named Hammer. And when we went to town school in Newton, in this case, Newton, Iowa, all the country kids seemed to have a better education than the town school kids. And so they had a leg up when we started mixing and competing with each other. But it was good. I remember one more thing. In that library, we had a collection of National Geographic magazines. And no, I wasn't hunting for the naked pictures, but I did find a picture of Kepler's nested spheres, and that just amazed me. Sir Johannes Kepler was back in the early 1600s and had this idea that all of the planets and the sun and everything were geometrically related, and had this model, and I saw that, and I've been fascinated all my life from that.
Your reminiscence should probably trigger some for Larry. What was your school like?
Well, it was a one-room frame schoolhouse. It was located about three-quarters of a mile from the farm home where I grew up. We walked to school every day, but that was really no big deal. You know, being on the farm, you were used to being outside basically from the time you got up in the morning until you came in the evening. So you were out, you were walking around. So you walk to school, well, that's no big deal. We just do that anyway. The weather was not a factor. You'd walk to school when it was warm or when it was cold. There's been a lot of talk recently about bread bags on your shoes, and I never saw anyone in my school wearing bread bags on their feet, but a lot of kids would wear five-buckle overshoes, and, when it rained in the spring, the road was not paved, was not graveled. It was pretty much like a cornfield, and that would be the tough walk right after a rainstorm. So,
well, I have one more question, and it really is for any of you, because somebody told me about school buses that took kids to country schools. I believe that was you, Bob. Could you tell us?
Well, I don't know that there were ever school buses taking kids to the country schools. In our particular case, in the school that I went all the way through, Gilbert, when they consolidated and they most of the nine country schools in Franklin Township went to Gilbert, then they had to buy buses to transport the kids to school. At one time, there were nine horse-drawn school buses to bring the kids to school, and quite a number of them were driven by the high school students. In one case in our community, the horse-drawn school bus was driven by an eighth-grade girl, and she was quite the pioneer-spirited gal, and she lived to be close to 100, and one of my classmates was her daughter. So it was quite an interesting experience.
This is amazing, and I think of today's helicopter parents, understanding all these risks that were taken by kids who really lived to be older. So maybe we ought to give our kids a little more slack in taking some risks. She's driving the school. Well, my brother was a high school senior and driving a regular school bus. He was class of 1945, and so they actually let a senior do this, you know. And, of course, today the litigation possibilities would just make you cringe, you know, when you talk about that. So we do indeed live in a different world, but, you know, what you fellows have described today is a time that really calls up not only the country life, but also the way everyone worked together and pulled together, and the kind of democratic way that kids related to each other in a one-room school. There weren't the divisions now between the grades that were so distinct. And everyone was in it together, and there's a lot to be said about that. And I really think, Sam, that you pointed out something great when you got to the public school in Newton, that you folks felt that you had an edge, that you had been well educated. And then we all have those great moments like you had with Kepler, where we have an educational breakthrough or serendipity experience that makes us feel like, yeah, it's fun to go to school.
There was one detriment for kids that came out of country schools, depending upon your psychological makeup, I guess. My mother related that when she left a country school and went to Clinton High School, she didn't feel socially accepted. And that was a little bit of a drawback of leaving the eighth grade education and then pursuing going on. I don't know that that's ever going to change. That happens with people. It appears to be somewhat the human situation.
That's true. We country school kids were outsiders when we merged in with the larger school.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, it's just it goes down to fundamental human behavior. Whoever is unfamiliar or different from us is suspect. And then that has to be dealt with somehow. So you depended on your personality and your ability to adjust to make that transition. Hey, guys, it's been fun today. Susan, hasn't been fun?
Sure has. And we've had a great time in the country schools. And now we're going to go to Webster City and find out about a little entertainment for the weekend. Thank you so much to all of you. This has been KHOI Community Radio, and our live guests for this portion of Country Schools have been Bob Jensen and Sam Wormley and Larry Kearson. And we're moving on to talk to Mark Andrew, the director of
Almost Maine.
This is KHOI Community Radio, where co-hosts Paul Wearson and Susan Franson have been talking with people who are trying to preserve the remaining old one- and two-room school buildings, as well as those who have memories of attending one of these schools.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been talking about country schools today. First, the buildings and the people working to preserve a few of them for us, and then firsthand memories of attending school in them.
Our guests today have been Bill Sherman, Barb McDougall, Bob Jensen, Sam Wormley, Larry Kearson, and Mark Andrew. Your hosts have been Paul Wearson and Susan Franson, and the show was engineered by Rebecca Brown.
Music you heard was Topsy Turvy Two Step by Louise V. Gustin, Fizzles by Two Step by Kate Meyer Smith, and The Gravel Rag by Charlotte Blake, as well as Honeybee. All performed by Nora Hulse, piano, from the CD Cakewalks, Two Steps, and Rags by Women Composers, 1899 to 1920. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Now you can also listen to this show and all of our past local talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org, where we are streaming live. You'll also find recent shows on our homepage with links to the organizations and other resources that have been mentioned in all our local talk shows.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate whatever fits into your budget. We'd also like to hear feedback either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line. Or stop in at the KHOI studios at 410 Douglas in Ames.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. And if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. Your participation as audience are what makes KHOY possible. Thank you for listening and
see you again on the radio.
KHOY is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.
Support for KHOI comes from C.Y. Stevens Auditorium, presenting Celtic Fire, an evening of songs, stories, tunes, and dance from the heart of the Emerald Isle. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.